Side 8, Chapter 19. "I've had a brilliant idea," said Stephen Katz. We were in the living room of my house in Hanover. It was 2 weeks later. We were leaving for Maine in the morning. "Oh, yeah?" I said, trying not to sound too wary, for ideas are not Katz's strongest suit. "You know how awful it is carrying a full pack?" I nodded. Of course I did. "Well, I was thinking about it the other day. In fact, I've been thinking about it a lot. Because to tell you the truth, Bryson, the idea of putting that pack on again filled me with..." He lowered his voice a tone. "Fucking dread." He nodded with solemnity and repeated the two key words. "And then I had a great idea. An alternative. Close your eyes." "What for?" "I want to surprise you." I hate having to close my eyes for a surprise. Always have. But I did it. I could hear him rooting in his army surplus duffel bag. "Who carries a lot of weight all the time?" he continued. "That was the question I asked myself. Who carries a lot of weight day in and day out? Hey, don't look yet." And then it occurred to me. He was silent a moment as if making some crucial adjustment that would assure a perfect imprint. Okay, now you can look. I uncovered my eyes. Katz, beaming immoderately, was wearing a Des Moines Register newspaper delivery bag, the kind of bright yellow pouch that paperboys in America traditionally sling over their shoulders before climbing on their bikes and riding off to do their rounds. "You can't be serious," I said quietly. "Never been more serious in my life, my old mountain friend. I brought you one, too." He handed me one from his duffel bag, still pristinely folded and in a transparent wrapper. "Stephen, you can't walk across the Maine wilderness with a newspaper delivery bag." "Why not? It's comfortable, it's waterproof, near enough, it's capacious, and it weighs all of about 4 ounces. It is the perfect hiking accessory. Let me ask you this. When was the last time you saw a paper boy with a hernia?" He nodded sagely, as if he had foxed me with that one. I made some tentative, preparatory shapes with my mouth prior to saying something, but Katz raced on before I could get a thought in order. "Here's the plan," he continued. "We cut our load down to the bare minimum. No stoves, no gas bottles, no noodles, no coffee, no tents, no stuff sacks, no sleeping bags. We hike and camp like mountain men. Did Daniel Boone have a 3-season fiber-filled sleeping bag? I don't think so. All we take is cold food, water bottles, maybe one change of clothes. I figure we can get the load down to 5 pounds. And," he waggled his hand delightedly in the empty newspaper bag, "we put it all in here." His expression begged me to drape him with plaudits. "Have you given any thought to how ridiculous you would look?" "Yep, don't care." "Have you considered what a source of uncontained mirth you would be to every person you met between here and Katahdin?" "Don't give the tiniest shit." "Well, has it occurred to you what a ranger would say if he found you setting off into the 100-mile wilderness with a newspaper delivery bag? Do you know they have the power to detain anyone they think is not mentally or physically fit?" This was actually a lie, but it brought a promising hint of frown to his brow. "Also, has it occurred to you that maybe the reason newspaper boys don't get hernias is that they only carry the bag for an hour or so a day? That maybe it might not be so comfortable lugging it for 10 hours at a stretch over mountains? That maybe it would bang endlessly against your legs and rub your shoulders raw? Look how it's chafing against your neck already." His eyes slid stealthily down to the strap. The one positive thing about Katz and his notions was that it was never very hard to talk him out of them. He took the bag off over his head. "Okay," he agreed. "Screw the bags, but we pack light." I was happy with that. In fact, it seemed a perfectly sensible proposal. We packed more than Katz wanted. I insisted on sleeping bags, warm clothes, and our tents, on the grounds that this could be a good deal more demanding than Katz appreciated. But I agreed to leave behind the stove, gas bottles, and pots and pans. We would eat cold stuff, principally Snickers, raisins, and an indestructible type of salami product called Slim Jims. It wouldn't kill us for a fortnight. Besides, I couldn't face another bowl of noodles. Altogether, we saved perhaps 5 pounds of weight each. Hardly anything, really. but Katz seemed disproportionately happy. It wasn't often he got his way, even in part. And so, the next day, my wife drove us deep into the boundless woods of northern Maine for our trek through the 100-mile wilderness. Maine is deceptive. It is the 12th smallest state, but it has more uninhabited forest, 10 million acres, than any other state but Alaska. In photographs, it looks serene and beckoning, almost park-like, with hundreds of cool, deep lakes and hazy, tranquil miles of undulating mountains. Only Katahdin, with its rocky upper slopes and startling muscularity, offers anything that looks faintly intimidating. In fact, it is all hard. The trail maintainers in Maine have a certain hale devotion to seeking out the rockiest climbs and most forbidding slopes, and of these, Maine has a breathtaking plenitude. In its 283 miles, the Appalachian Trail in Maine presents the northbound hiker with almost 100,000 feet of climb, the equivalent of three Everests. And at the heart of it all lies the famous 100-mile wilderness, 99.7 miles of boreal forest trail, without a shop, house, or paved road, running from the village of Monson to a public campground at Abel Bridge, just below Katahdin. It is the remotest section of the entire AT. If something goes wrong in the 100-mile wilderness, you are on your own. You could die of an infected blood blister out there. It takes a week to 10 days for most people to cross this fabled expanse. Because we had a fortnight, we had my wife drop us at Caratunk, a remote village on the Kennebec River, 38 miles short of Monson and the official start of the wilderness. We would have 3 days of limbering up and a chance to resupply at Monson before plunging irreversibly into the deepest woods. I had already done a little hiking to the west around Rangeley and Flagstaff Lakes in the week before Katz came, as a kind of reconnoiter, so I felt as if I knew the terrain. Even so, it was a shock. It was the first time in almost 4 months that I had hoisted a pack with a full load. I couldn't believe the weight. Couldn't believe that there had ever been a time when I could believe the weight. The strain was immediate and discouraging, but at least I had been hiking. Katz, it was quickly evident, was starting from square one. Actually, several score pancake breakfasts to the wrong side of square one. From Caratunk, it was a long, gently upward haul of 5 miles to a big lake called Pleasant Pond, hardly taxing at all. But I noticed right away that he was moving with incredible deliberativeness, breathing very hard, and wearing a kind of shocked, "Where am I?" expression. All he would utter was, "Man," in an amazed tone when I asked him how he was, and a single heartfelt, "Fuck!" breathy and protracted like the noise of a plumped cushion when someone sits on it, when he let his pack fall from his back at the first rest stop after 45 minutes. It was a muggy afternoon, and Katz was a river of sweat. He took a water bottle and downed nearly half of it. Then he looked at me with quietly desperate eyes, put his pack back on, and wordlessly returned to his duty. Pleasant Pond was a holiday spot. We could hear the happy shrieks of children splashing and swimming perhaps 100 yards away, though we couldn't see anything of the lake through the trees. Indeed, without their gaiety, we wouldn't have known it was there. A sobering reminder of how suffocating the woods can be. Beyond rose Middle Mountain, just 2,500 feet high, but acutely angled, and an entirely different experience on a hot day with a cumbersome pack sagging down on tender shoulders. I plodded joylessly on to the top of the mountain. Katz was soon far behind and moving with shuffling slowness. It was after 6 o'clock when I reached the base of the mountain on the other side and found a decent campsite beside a grassy, little-used logging road at a place called Baker Stream. I waited a few minutes for Katz, then put up my tent. When he still hadn't come after 20 minutes, I went looking for him. He was almost an hour behind me when I finally found him, and his expression was glassy-eyed. I took his pack from him and sighed at the discovery that it was light. "What's happened to your pack?"
"Ah, I threw some stuff," he said unhappily.
"What?"
"Oh, clothes and stuff." He seemed uncertain whether to be ashamed or belligerent. He decided to try belligerence. That stupid sweater, for one thing. We had disputed mildly over the need for woolens. But it could get cold. It's very changeable in the mountains.
Yeah, right, it's August, Bryson. I don't know if you noticed.
There didn't seem much point in trying to reason with him. When we reached the camp and he was putting up his tent, I looked into his pack. He had thrown away nearly all his spare clothes, and it appeared a good deal of the food. "Where's the peanuts?" I said. "Where's all your Slim Jims?"
"We didn't need all that shit. It's only 3 days to Monson."
"Most of that food was for the 100-mile wilderness, Stephen. We don't know what kind of supplies there'll be in Monson."
"Oh."
He looked struck and contrite.
"I thought it was a lot for 3 days."
I looked despairingly in the pack and then looked round. "Where's your other water bottle?" He looked at me sheepishly.
"I threw it."
"You threw a water bottle?" This was truly staggering. If there is one thing you need on the trail in August, it is lots of water.
"It was heavy."
"Of course it's heavy. Water's always heavy, but it is also kind of vital, wouldn't you say?" He gave me a helpless look.
"I just had to get rid of some weight. I was desperate."
"No, you were stupid."
"Yeah, that too," he agreed.
"Stephen, I wish you wouldn't do these things."
"I know," he said, and looked sincerely repentant.
While he finished putting up his tent, I went off to filter water for the morning. Baker Stream was really a river, broad, clear, and shallow, and very beautiful in the glow of a summery evening with a backdrop of overhanging trees and the last rays of sunlight sparkling its surface. As I knelt by the water, I became curiously aware of something, some thing, in the woods beyond my left shoulder, which caused me to straighten up and peer through the clutter of foliage at the water's edge. Goodness knows what impelled me to look, because I couldn't have heard anything over the musical tumult of water. But there, about 15 feet away in the dusky undergrowth, staring at me with a baleful expression, was a moose, full-grown and female, or so I presumed, since it had no antlers. It had evidently been on its way to the water for a drink, when it was brought up short by my presence, and now clearly was undecided what to do next. It is an extraordinary experience to find yourself face to face in the woods with a wild animal that is very much larger than you. You know these things are out there, of course, but you never expect at any particular moment to encounter one, certainly not up close. And this one was close enough for me to see the flea-like insects floating in circles about its head. We stared at each other for a good minute, neither of us sure what to do. There was a certain obvious and gratifying tang of adventure in this, but also something much more low-key and elemental, a kind of respectful mutual acknowledgement that comes with sustained eye contact. It was this that was unexpectedly thrilling, the sense that there was in some small measure a salute in our cautious mutual appraisal. Very slowly, so as not to alarm it, I crept off to get cats. When we returned, the moose had advanced to the water and was drinking about 25 feet upstream.
"Wow,"
Katz breathed. He was thrilled, too, I was pleased to note. The moose looked up at us, decided we meant her no harm, and went back to drinking. We watched her for perhaps 5 minutes, but the mosquitoes were chewing us up, so we withdrew and returned to our camp, feeling considerably elated. It seemed a kind of confirmation. We were in the wilderness now, and an agreeable reward for a day of hard toil. We ate a dinner of Slim Jims, raisins, and Snickers, and retired to our tents to escape the endless assault of mosquitoes. As we lay there, Kat said quite brightly,
"Hard day today. I'm beat."
It was unlike him to be chatty at tent time. I grunted in agreement.
"I'd forgotten how hard it is."
"Yeah. Me too.
First days are always hard, though, aren't they?"
"Yeah." He gave a settling down sigh and yawned melodiously.
"It'll be better tomorrow," he said, still yawning.
By this he meant, I suppose, that he wouldn't fling anything foolish away.
"Well, good night," he added.
I stared at the wall of my tent in the direction from which his voice had come. In all the weeks of camping together, It was the first time he had wished me a good night. "Good night," I said. I rolled over on my side. He was right, of course. First days are always bad. Tomorrow would be better. We were both asleep in minutes. Well, we were both wrong. The next day started well enough, with a sunny dawn that promised another hot day. It was the first time along the trail that we had woken to warmth, and we enjoyed the novelty of it. We packed up our tents, breakfasted on raisins and Snickers, and set off into the deep woods. By 9 o'clock, the sun was already high and blazing. Even on hot days, the woods are normally cool, but here the air was heavy and listless and steamy, almost tropical. About 2 hours after setting off, we came to a lagoon, about 2 acres in size, I would guess, and filled with papery reeds, fallen trees, and the bleached torsos of dead trees that were still standing. Dragonflies danced across the surface. Beyond, waiting, rose a titanic heap called Moxie Bald Mountain. But what was of immediate note was that the trail ended abruptly and puzzlingly at the water's edge. Katz and I looked at each other. Something wrong here, surely. For the first time since Georgia, we wondered if we had lost the trail. God knows what Chicken John would have made of it. We retraced our steps a considerable distance, studied our map and trail guide, tried to find an alternative way round the pond through the hot and impenetrable undergrowth on every side, and finally concluded that we were intended to ford it. On the far shore, perhaps 80 yards away, Kat spied a white AT blaze. Clearly, we had to wade across. Katz led the way, barefoot and in boxer shorts, using a long stick like a punting pole to try to pick his way across on a jumble of submerged or half-submerged logs. I followed in a similar manner, but staying far enough back not to put my weight on a log he was using. They were covered in a slick moss and tended to bob or rotate alarmingly when stepped on. Twice he nearly toppled over. Finally, about 25 yards out, he lost it altogether, and plunged with wheeling arms and an unhappy wail into the murky water. He went completely under, came up, went under again, and came up flailing and floundering with such wildness that for a few sincerely mortifying moments I thought he was drowning. The weight of his pack was clearly dragging him backwards and keeping him from gaining an upright position, or even successfully keeping his head above water. I was about to drop my pack and plunge in to help when he managed to catch hold of a log and pull himself to a standing position. The water was up to his chest. He clung to the log and heaved visibly with the effort of catching his breath and calming himself down. He had obviously had a fright. "You all right?" I said. "Oh, peachy," he replied. "Just peachy. I don't know why they couldn't have put some crocodiles in here and made a real adventure of it." I crept on, and an instant later I tumbled in, too. I had a few surreal, slow-motion moments of observing the world from the unusual perspective of the waterline, or just below. While my hand reached helplessly for a log that was just beyond my grasp, all this in a curious, bubbly silence, before Kat sloshed to my assistance, firmly grabbed my shirt, and thrust me back into a world of light and noise, and set me on my feet. He was surprisingly strong. "Thank you," I gasped. "Don't mention it." We waded heavily to the far shore, taking it in turns to stumble and help each other up, and sloshed up onto the muddy bank, trailing strands of half-rotted vegetation and draining huge volumes of water from our packs. We dumped our loads and sat on the ground, bedraggled and spent, and stared at the lagoon as if it had just played a terrible practical joke on us. I could not remember feeling this exhausted this early in the day anywhere along the trail. As we sat there, there were voices, and 2 young hikers, hippyish and very fit, emerged from the woods behind us. They nodded hellos and looked appraisingly at the water. "Afraid you gotta wade this one," Kat said. One of the hikers looked at him in a not unkindly way. "This your first time hiking up here?" he said. We nodded. "Well, I don't want to discourage you, but mister, you've only just started to get wet." With that, he and his partner hoisted their packs above their heads, wished us luck, and walked into the water. They waded skillfully across in perhaps 30 seconds. Katz and I had taken as many minutes, and stepped out on the other side as if from a foot bath, put their dry packs back on, gave a small wave, and disappeared. Katz took a big, thoughtful breath, partly sigh, partly just experimenting with the ability to breathe again.
Bryson, I'm not trying to be negative. I swear to God I'm not. But I'm not sure I'm cut out for this. Could you lift your pack over your head like that?
No. And on that premonitory note, we strapped up and set squelchily off up Moxie Bald Mountain. The Appalachian Trail was the hardest thing I have ever done, and the main portion was the hardest part of the Appalachian Trail, and by a factor I couldn't begin to compute. Partly it was the heat. Maine, that most moderate of states, was having a killer heat wave. In the baking sun, the shadeless granite pavements of Moxie Bald radiated an oven-like heat. But even in the woods, the air was oppressive and close, as if the trees and foliage were breathing on us with a hot, vegetative breath. We sweated helplessly, copiously, and drank unusual quantities of water, but could never stop being thirsty. Water was sometimes plentiful, but more often non-existent for long stretches, so that we were never sure how much we could prudently swallow without leaving ourselves short later on. Even fully stocked, we were short now, thanks to Katz's dumping a bottle. Finally, there were the insects, which were relentless, the strangely unsettling sense of isolation, and the ever-taxing terrain. Katz responded to this in a way that I had never seen. He showed a kind of fixated resolve, as if the only way to deal with this problem was to bowl through it and get it over with. The next morning, we came very early to the first of several rivers we would have to ford. It was called Bald Mountain Stream, but in fact, it was a river, broad, lively, strewn with boulders. It was exceedingly fetching. It glittered with dancing spangles in the early morning sun and was gorgeously clear. But the current seemed strong, and there was no telling from the shore how deep it might be in the middle. Several large streams in the area, my Appalachian trail guide to Maine noted blithely, can be difficult or dangerous to cross in high water. I decided not to share this with Katz. We took off our shoes and socks, rolled up our trousers, and stepped gingerly out into the frigid water. The stones on the bottom were all shapes and sizes, flat, egg-shaped, domed, very hard on the feet, and covered with a filmy green slime that was ludicrously slippery. I hadn't gone 3 steps when my feet skated and I fell painfully on my ass. I struggled halfway to my feet, but slipped and fell again. Struggled up, staggered sideways a yard or two, and pitched helplessly forward, breaking my fall with my hands and ending up in the water doggy style. As I landed, my pack slid forward and my boots, tied to its frame by their laces, were hurled into a kind of contained orbit. They flew around the side of the pack in a long, rather pretty trajectory, and came to a halt against my head, then plunked into the water where they dangled in the current. As I crouched there, breathing evenly, and telling myself that one day this would be a memory, 2 young guys, clones almost of the 2 we had seen the day before, strode past with confident, splashing steps, packs above their heads. "Fall down?" said one brightly. "No, I just wanted a closer look at the water, you moronic fit twit." I went back to the riverbank, pulled on my soaked boots, and discovered that it was infinitely easier crossing with them on. I got a tolerable grip, and the rocks didn't hurt as they had on my bare feet. I crossed cautiously, alarmed at the force of the current in the center. Each time I lifted a leg, the current tried to reposition it downstream as if it belonged to a gate-legged table. But the water was never more than about 3 feet deep, and I reached the other side without falling. Katz, meantime, had discovered a way across using boulders as stepping stones, but ended up stranded on the edge of a noisy torrent of what looked like deep water. He stood there covered with frowns. I couldn't for the life of me figure out how he had got up there. His boulder seemed isolated in an expanse of dangerously streaming water from all sides, and clearly he didn't know what to do now. He tried to ease himself into the water to wade the last 10 yards to shore, and was instantly whisked away like a feather. For the second time in 2 days, I sincerely thought he was drowning. He was certainly helpless, but the current carried him to a shallow bar of gleaming pebbles 20 feet further on, where he came up sputtering on his hands and knees, struggled up onto the bank, and continued on into the woods without a backward glance, as if this were the most normal thing in the world. And so we pressed on to Monson, over hard trail and more rivers, collecting bruises and scratches and insect bites that turned our backs into relief maps. On the third day, forest dazed and grubby, we stepped onto a sunny road, the first since Caratunk, and followed it on a hot ambulation into the forgotten hamlet of Monson. Near the center of town was an old clapboard house, with a painted wooden cutout of a bearded hiker standing on the lawn, bearing the message, "Welcome at Shaw's." Shaw's is the most famous guest house on the AT, partly because it's the last comfort stop for anyone going into the 100-mile wilderness, and the first for anyone coming out, but also because it's very friendly and good value. For $28 each, we got a room, dinner, and breakfast, and free use of the shower, laundry, and guest lounge. The place was run by Keith and Pat Shaw, who started the business more or less by accident 20 years ago, when Keith brought home a hungry hiker off the trail, and the hiker passed on the word of how well he had been treated. Just a few weeks earlier, Keith told me proudly as we signed in, they had registered their 20,000th hiker. We had an hour till dinner. Katz borrowed $5 for Pop, I presumed, and vanished to his room. I had a shower, put a load of washing in the machine, and wandered out to the front lawn, where there were a couple of Adirondack chairs on which I intended to park my weary butt, smoke my pipe, and savor the blissful ease of late afternoon and the pleasant anticipation of a dinner earned. From a screened window nearby came the sounds of sizzling food and the clatter of pans. It smelled good, whatever it was. After a minute, Keith came out and sat with me. He was an old guy, comfortably into his 60s, with almost no teeth, and a body that looked as if it had put up with all kinds of tough stuff in its day. He was real friendly.
"You didn't try to pet the dog, did you?" he said.
"No. I had seen it from the window, an ugly, vicious mongrel that was tied up behind the house and got stupidly and disproportionately worked up by any noise or movement within 100 yards.
You don't want to try to pet the dog. Take it from me. You do not want to pet that dog. Some hiker petted him last week when I told him not to and had bit him in the balls."
"Really?" He nodded.
"Wouldn't let go, neither. You should have heard that feller wail."
"Really?"
"Had to hit the damn dog with a rake to get him to let go. Meanest damn dog I ever seen in my life. You don't want to get near him, believe me."
"How was the hiker?"
"Well, it didn't exactly make his day, I tell you that."
He scratched his neck contemplatively, as if he were thinking of having a shave one of these days.
"Through hiker he was. Come all the way from Georgia. Long way to come to get your balls nipped."
Then he went off to check on dinner. Dinner was at a big dining room table that was generously covered in platters of meat, bowls of mashed potatoes and corn on the cob, a teetering plate of bread, a tub of butter. Katz arrived a few moments after me, looking freshly showered and very happy. He seemed unusually, almost exaggeratedly energized, and gave me an impetuous tickle from behind as he passed, which was out of character. "You all right?" I said.
"Never been better, my old mountain companion. Never been better."
We were joined by two others, a sweetly hesitant and wholesome-looking young couple, both tanned and fit, and also very clean. Katz and I welcomed them with smiles and started to pitch in, then paused and put back the bowls, when we realized the couple were mumbling grace. This seemed to go on forever. Then we pitched in again. The food was terrific. Keith acted as waiter and was most insistent that we eat plenty.
"Dog'll eat it if you don't," he said.
I was happy to let the dog starve. The young couple were through hikers from Indiana. They had started at Springer on 28 March, a date that seemed impossibly snow-flecked and distant, now in the full heat of an August evening, and had hiked continuously for 141 days. They'd completed 2,045.5 miles. They had 114.9 miles to go. "So you've nearly done it, huh?" I said, a trifle inanely, but just trying to make conversation. "Yes," said the girl. She said it slowly, as two syllables, as if it hadn't previously occurred to her. There was something serenely mindless in her manner. "Did you ever feel like giving up?" The girl thought for a moment. "No," she said simply. "Really?" I found this amazing. "Did you never think, geez, this is too much? I don't know that I want to go through with this." She thought again with an air of encroaching panic. These were obviously questions that had never penetrated her skull. Her partner came to her rescue. "We had a couple of low moments in the early phases," he said, "but we put our faith in the Lord, and his will prevailed." "Praise Jesus," whispered the girl, almost inaudibly. "Ah," I said, and made a mental note to lock my door when I went to bed.
"And God bless Allah for the mashed potatoes," said Katz happily, and reached for the bowl for the third time.
After dinner, Katz and I strolled to a general store up the road to get supplies for the 100-mile wilderness, which we would start in the morning. He seemed odd in the grocery store, cheerful enough, but distracted and inattentive. We were supposed to be stocking up for 10 days in the wilds, a fairly serious business, but he seemed unwilling to focus and kept wandering off or picking up inappropriate things like chili sauce and tin openers. "Hey, let's get a six-pack," he said suddenly in a party voice. "Come on, Stephen, get serious," I said. I was looking at cheeses. "I am serious. Do you want cheddar or Colby?" "Whatever." He wandered off to the beer cooler and came back carrying a six-pack of Budweiser. "Hey, what do you say to a six-pack, bud? A six-pack of Bud, bud?" He nudged me in the ribs to emphasize the joke. I pulled away from the nudge and distraction. "Come on, Stephen, stop dicking around." I had moved on to the chocolate bars and biscuits and was trying to figure out what might last us 10 days without melting into a disgusting ooze or bouncing into a bag of crumbs. "Do you want Snickers or do you want to try something different?" I asked. "I want Budweiser." He grinned. Then, seeing this had passed me by, adopted a sudden solemn, jokeless tone. "Please, Bryson, can I borrow," he looked at the price, $4.79? "I'm broke." "Stephen, I don't know what's come over you. Put the beer back. Anyway, what happened to that $5 I gave you?"
"Spent it."
"What on?" And then it occurred to me. "You've been drinking already, haven't you?"
"No,"
he said robustly, as if dismissing a preposterous and possibly slanderous allegation. But he was drunk, or at least half drunk. "You have," I said in amazement. He sighed and rolled his eyes slightly.
"Two quarts of Michelob, big deal."
"You've been drinking." I was appalled. "When did you start drinking again?"
"In Des Moines, just a little, you know. A couple of beers after work, nothing to get in a panic about."
"Stephen, you know you can't drink." He didn't want to hear this. He looked like a 14-year-old who'd just been told to clean up his room.
"I don't need a lecture, Bryson."
"I'm not going to buy you beer," I said evenly. He grinned as if I were being unaccountably priggish.
"Just a six-pack, come on."
"No." I was furious, livid, more furious than I had been about anything in years. I couldn't believe he was drinking again. It seemed such a deep, foolish betrayal of everything, of himself, me, what we were doing out here. Katz was still wearing half a grin, but it didn't belong to his emotions any longer.
"So you're not going to buy me a couple of lousy beers after all I've done for you?"
This seemed a low blow.
"No."
"Then fuck you," he said, and turned on his heel and walked out. Chapter 20. Well, that rather colored things, as you can imagine. We never said another word about it. It just hung there. At breakfast, we exchanged good mornings, more or less as normal, but didn't speak beyond that. And afterwards, as we waited by Keith's van for a promised lift to the trailhead, we stood in an awkward silence, like adversaries in a property dispute, waiting to be summoned into the judge's chambers. At the edge of the woods when we alighted, there was a sign announcing that this was the start of the 100-mile wilderness, with a long, soberly phrased warning to the effect that what lay beyond was not like other stretches of the trail, and that you shouldn't proceed if you didn't have at least 10 days' worth of food and weren't feeling pretty tip-top. It gave the woods a more ominous, vaguely moody feel. They were unquestionably different from woods further south, darker, more shadowy, inclining more to black than green. There were different trees, too, more conifers at low levels and many more birches. And scattered through the undergrowth were large, rounded black boulders like sleeping animals, which lent the still recesses a certain eeriness. When Walt Disney decided to make Bambi, he dispatched his artists to the Maine woods to make sketches, but this was palpably not a Disney wood of roomy glades and cuddlesome creatures. This brought to mind the woods in The Wizard of Oz, where the trees have ugly faces and malign intent, and every step seems a gamble. This was a wood for looming bears, dangling snakes, wolves with laser-red eyes. I understood at once why the velvet-jacketed Henry David Thoreau shat himself here. As ever, the trail was well-blazed, but in places almost overgrown, with ferns and other low foliage almost meeting in the middle over the path. Since only 10% of through hikers make it this far, and it is much too distant for most day hikers, the trail in Maine is more thinly used. Above all, what set the trail apart was the terrain. In profile, the topography of the AT over the 18-mile section from Monson to Barren Mountain looks reasonably undemanding, rolling along at a more or less steady 1,200 feet, with just a few steep rises and falls. In fact, it was hell. Within half an hour, we had come to a wall of rock, the first of many, perhaps 400 feet high. The trail ran up its face, along a slight depression, like a lift shaft. It was as near perpendicular as a slope can get, without actually being a rock climb. Slowly and laboriously, we picked our way between and over boulders, using our hands as much as our feet. Combined with our exertion, the cloying heat was almost unbearable. I found I had to stop every 10 or 12 yards to draw breath and wipe burning sweat from my eyes. I was swimming in heat, bathed in heat, swaddled in it. I don't believe I have ever been so warm or sweated so freely. I drank 3/4 of a bottle of water on the way up, and used much of the rest to wet a bandana and try to cool my throbbing head. I felt dangerously overheated and faint. I began to rest more frequently, and for longer periods, to try to cool down a little. But each time I set off again, the heat came flooding back. I never had to work so hard or so tiringly to clear an Appalachian impediment, and this was just the first of a series. The top of the climb brought several 100 yards of bare, gently sloping granite, like walking along a whale's back. From each summit, the panorama was sensational, for as far as the eye could see, nothing but heavy green woods, denim-blue lakes, and undulant mountains. Many of the lakes were immense, as big as Windermere at least, and nearly all of them had probably never felt so much as a human toe. There was a certain captivating sense of having penetrated into a secret corner of the world, but in the murderous sun, it was impossible to linger. Then came a difficult and unnerving descent down a rocky cliff face on the other side, a short walk through a dark, waterless valley, and delivery to the foot of another wall of rock. And so the day went, with monumental climbs, and the hope of water over the next hill, the principal thing drawing us on. Katz was soon out of water altogether. I gave him a drink of mine, and he accepted it gratefully, with a look that asked for a truce. There was, however, still a kind of odor between us, an unhappy sense that things had changed and would not be the same again. It was doubtless my fault. I pushed on further and longer than we would have normally and without consulting him, unsubtly punishing him for having unbalanced the equilibrium that had existed between us, and Katz bore it silently as his due. We did 14 miles, an exceedingly worthy distance in the circumstances, and might have gone further, but at 6:30 we came to a broad ford called Wilbur Brook, and stopped. We were too tired to cross. That is to say, I was too tired, and it would be folly to get wet so near sundown. We made camp and shared out our cheerless rations with a kind of strained politeness. Even if we had not been at odds, we would scarcely have spoken. We were too tired. It had been a long day, the hardest of the trip, and the thought that hung over us was that we had 85 more miles of this before we got to the camp store at Abel Bridge, 100 miles till we reached the difficult summit of Katahdin. Even then, we had no prospect of real comfort. Katahdin is in Baxter State Park, which takes a certain hearty pride in its devotion to ruggedness and deprivation. There are no restaurants and lodges, no gift shops and hamburger stands, not even any paved roads. The park itself is in the middle of nowhere, a two-day hike from Millinocket at the nearest town. It could be 10 or 11 days before we had a proper meal or slept in a bed. It seemed a long way off. In the morning, we silently forded the stream. We were getting pretty good at it now, and started up the long, slow climb to the roof of the barren Chairback Range, 15 miles of ragged summits that we had to cross before descending to a more tranquil spell in the valley of the Pleasant River. The map showed just 3 tarns in those mountains, glacial leftovers, all off the trail, but otherwise no indication of water at all. With less than 4 liters of water capacity between us, and the day already warm, the long haul between water sources promised to be, at the very least, uncomfortable. Barren Mountain was a strenuous slog, much of it straight up, and all of it hot, though we seemed to be getting stronger. Even Katz was moving with a comparative lightness. The weather remained sultry. It took us nearly all the morning to hike the 4.5 miles up. I reached the top sometime ahead of Katz. The summit was sun-warmed granite, hot to the touch, but there was a wisp of breeze, the first in days, and I found a shady spot beneath a disused fire tower. It was the first time in what seemed like weeks that I had sat anywhere in relative comfort. I leaned back and felt as if I could sleep for a month. Katz arrived 10 minutes later, puffing hard but pleased to be at the top. He took a seat on a boulder beside mine. I had about 2 inches of water left and passed him the bottle. He took a very modest sip and made to hand it back. "Go on," I said. "You must be thirsty." "Thanks." He took a slightly less modest sip and put the bottle down. He sat for a minute, then got out a Snickers, broke it in two, and extended half to me. It was a somewhat odd thing to do because I had a Snickers of my own, and he knew that, but he had nothing else to give. "Thanks," I said. He gnawed off a bite of Snickers, ate for a minute, and said from out of nowhere, "Girlfriend and boyfriend are talking." The girlfriend says to the boyfriend, "Jimmy, how do you spell pedophilia?" The boyfriend looks at her in amazement. "Gosh, honey," he says, "that's an awfully big word for an 8-year-old. I laughed. "I'm sorry about the other night," Kat said. "Me too. I just got a little, I don't know, I know. It's kind of hard for me sometimes," he went on. "I try, Bryson, I really do, but..." He stopped there and shrugged reflectively, a little helplessly. "There's just this kind of hole in my life, where drinking used to be." He was staring at the view, the usual verdant infinity of woods and lakes, shimmering slightly in a heat haze. There was something in his gaze, a miles-away fixedness, that made me think for a minute he had stopped altogether, but he went on. "When I went back to Des Moines after Virginia and got that job building houses, at the end of the day, all the crew would go off to this tavern across the street. They'd always invite me, but I'd say," he lifted 2 hands and put on a deep, righteous voice, "'No, boys, I'm reformed.' And I'd go home to my little apartment and heat a TV dinner and feel all virtuous, like I'm supposed to. But really, you know, when you do that night after night, it's kind of hard to persuade yourself you're leading a rich and thrilling existence. I mean, if you had a funometer, the needle wouldn't exactly be jumping into the orgasmic zone because you've got your own TV dinner. You know what I'm saying?" He glanced over to see me nod. "So anyway, one day after work, they invited me for about the 100th time, and I thought, oh, what the hell?
No law that says I can't go in a tavern like anybody else. So I went and had a Diet Coke, and it was okay. I mean, it was nice just to be out. But you know how good a beer is at the end of a long day. And there was this jerk named Duane who kept saying, "Go on, have a beer. You know you want one. One little beer is not going to hurt you. You haven't had a drink for 3 years. You can handle it." He looked at me again. "You know?" I nodded. "Caught me when I was vulnerable," Kat said with a hard, ironic smile. "You know, when I was still breathing." "I never had more than three, I swear to God." "I know what you're going to say. Believe me, everybody said it already. I know I can't drink. I know I can't have just a couple of beers like a normal person. That pretty soon the number will creep up and spin out of control. I know that. But," he stopped there again, shaking his head, "but I love to drink. I can't help it. I mean, I love it, Bryson. Love the taste, love that buzz you get when you've had a couple, love the smell and feel of taverns. I miss dirty stories and the click of pool balls in the background and that kind of bluish, underlit glow of a bar at night." He was quiet again for a minute, lost in a little reverie for a lifetime's drinking. "And I can't have it anymore. I know that." He breathed out heavily through his nostrils. "It's just that. It's just that sometimes all I see ahead of me is TV dinners, a sort of endless line of them dancing towards me like in a cartoon. You ever eat TV dinners?" "Not for years and years." "Well, they're shit, believe me. And, I don't know, it's just kind of hard." He trailed off. "Actually, it's real hard." He looked at me on the edge of emotion, his expression frank and humble. "Makes me kind of an asshole sometimes," he said quietly but sincerely. I gave him a smile. "Makes you more of an asshole," I said. He grunted a laugh. "Yeah, I guess." I reached over and gave him a stupidly affectionate jab on the shoulder. He received it with a flicker of appreciation. "And do you know what the fuck of it is?" he said in a sudden pull-yourself-together voice. "I could kill for a TV dinner right now. I really could." We laughed. "Hungry man turkey dinner with plastic giblets and 40-weight gravy. Mmm. I'd leave your scrawny ass up here just for a sniff of that." Then he brushed at a corner of his eye, said, "Oh, fuck," and went to have a pee over the cliff edge. I watched him go, looking old and tired, and wondered for a minute what on earth we were doing up here. We weren't boys anymore. I looked at the map. We were practically out of water, but it was less than a mile to Cloud Pond, where we could refill. We split the last half inch, and I told Katz I would go on ahead to the pond, filter the water, and have it waiting for him when he arrived. It was an easy 20-minute walk along a grassy ridgeline. Cloud Pond was down a steep side trail, about a quarter of a mile off the AT. I left my pack propped against a rock at the trail side and went with our water bottles and the filter down to the pond edge and filled up. It took me perhaps 20 minutes to walk down, fill the three bottles, and walk back. So when I returned to the AT, it had been about 40 minutes since I had seen Katz. Even if he had tarried on the mountaintop, and even allowing for his modest walking speed, he should have reached here by now. Besides, it was an easy walk, and I knew he was thirsty. So it was odd that he wasn't here more promptly. I waited 15 minutes, and then 20, and 25, and finally I left my pack and went back to look for him. It was well over an hour since I had seen him when I reached the mountaintop, and he wasn't there. I stood confounded on the spot where we had last been together. His stuff was gone. He had obviously moved on. But if he wasn't on Barren Mountain, and wasn't at Cloud Pond, and was nowhere in between, then where was he? The only possible explanations were that he had gone back the other way, which was out of the question. Katz would never have left me without explanation. Never. Or that he had somehow fallen off the ridgeline. It was an absurd notion. There wasn't anything remotely challenging or dangerous about the ridgeline. But you never know. John Connolly had told us weeks before
of a friend of his who had fainted in the heat and tumbled a few feet off a safe, level trail. He had lain unnoticed for hours in blazing sunshine and slowly baked to death. All the way back to the Cloud Pond turnoff, I carefully surveyed the trail-edge brush for signs of disturbance and peered at intervals over the lip of the ridge, fearful of seeing cats spread-eagled on a rock. I called his name several times and got nothing in return but my own fading voice. By the time I reached the turnoff, it had been nearly 2 hours since I had seen him. This was becoming worryingly inexplicable. The only remaining possibility was that he had walked past the turnoff while I was down at the pond filtering water, but this seemed manifestly improbable. There was a prominent arrowed sign by the trail saying Cloud Pond, and my pack had been clearly visible beside the trail. Even if he had somehow failed to notice these things, he knew that Cloud Pond was only a mile from Barren Mountain. When you have hiked the AT as much as we had, you get so you can judge a mile with considerable accuracy. He couldn't have gone too far beyond without realizing his mistake and coming back. This just didn't make sense. All I knew was that Katz was alone in a wilderness with no water, no map, no clear idea of what terrain lay ahead, presumably no idea of what had become of me, and a worrying lack of sense. If there was ever one person who would decide, while lost on the AT, to leave the trail and try for a shortcut, it was Katz. I began to feel extremely uneasy. I left a note on my pack and went off down the trail. A half mile further on, the trail descended very steeply, almost perpendicularly, more than 600 feet, to a deep, nameless valley. He had to have realized by this point, surely, that he had gone wrong. I had told him Cloud Pond was a level stroll. Calling his name at intervals, I picked my way slowly along the path down the cliff face, fearing the worst at the bottom, for this was a precipice one could easily fall down, especially with a big ungainly pack and a preoccupied mind, but there was no sign of him. I followed the trail 2 miles through the valley and up onto the summit of a high pinnacle called Fourth Mountain. The view from the top was expansive in every direction. The wilderness had never looked so big. I called his name long and hard and got nothing in return. It was getting on for late afternoon by this time. He had been at least 4 hours without water. I had no idea how long a person could survive without water in this heat, but I knew from experience that you couldn't go for more than half an hour without experiencing considerable discomfort. It occurred to me with a sinking feeling that he might have seen another pond. There were half a dozen to choose from, scattered across the valley 2,000 feet below, and decided in his perplexity that perhaps that was it, and tried to reach it cross-country. Even if he wasn't confused, he might simply have been driven by thirst to try to reach one of those ponds. They looked wonderfully cool and refreshing. The nearest was only about 2 miles away, but there was no trail to it, and it was down a perilous slope through the woods. Once you were in the woods and bereft of bearings, you could easily miss it by a mile. Conversely, you could be within 50 yards of it and not know, as we had seen at Pleasant Pond a few days before. And once you were lost in these immense woods, you would die. It was as simple as that. No one could save you. No helicopter could spot you through the cover of trees. No rescue teams could find you. None, I suspected, would even try. There would be bears down there, too. Bears that had possibly never seen a human. All the possibilities made my head hurt. I hiked back to the Cloud Pond turnoff, hoping more than anything I had hoped for in a long time that he would be sitting on the pack, and that there would be some amusing, unconsidered explanation, that we had kept just missing each other, like in a stage farce, him waiting bewildered at my pack, then going off to look for me arriving a moment later, waiting in puzzlement, and going off. But I knew he wouldn't be there, and he wasn't. It was nearly dusk when I got back. I wrote a fresh note and left it under a rock in the middle of the AT, just in case, hoisted my pack and went down to the pond where there was a shelter. The irony was that this was the nicest campsite I experienced anywhere along the AT, and it was the one place I camped without cats. Cloud Pond was a couple of hundred acres of exquisitely peaceful water, surrounded by dark coniferous forest, the treetops pointy black silhouettes against a pale blue evening sky. The shelter, which I had to myself, was on a level area, 30 or 40 yards back from the pond and slightly above it. It was practically new and spotless. There was a privy nearby. It was nearly perfect. I dumped my stuff on the wooden sleeping platform and went down to the water's edge to filter water, so I wouldn't have to do it in the morning. Then stripped to my boxers and waded a couple of feet into the dark water to have a wash with a bandana. If Katz had been there, I'd have had a swim. I tried not to think about him, certainly not to visualize him lost and bewildered. There was, after all, nothing I could do now. Instead, I sat on a rock and watched the sunset. The pond was almost painfully beautiful. The long rays of the setting sun made the water shimmer golden. Offshore, two loons cruised, as if out for a spin after supper. I watched them for a long time and thought about something I had seen in a BBC Nature program some time before. Loons, according to the program, are not social creatures. But towards the end of summer, just before they fly back to the North Atlantic, where they pass the winter bobbing on stormy waves, they host a series of get-togethers. A dozen or more loons from all the neighboring ponds fly in, and they all swim around together for a couple of hours for no discernible reason other than the pleasure of being together. The host loon leads the guests on a proud but low-key tour of his territory, first to his favorite little cove, say, then perhaps over to an interesting fallen log, then on to a patch of lily pads. "This is where I like to fish in the mornings," he seems to be saying, "and here's where we're thinking of moving our nesting site next year." All the other loons follow him around with diligence and polite interest. No one knows why they do this. But then, no one knows why one human being would want to show another his converted bathroom, or how they arrange their rendezvous. But they all show up each night, at the right lake at the right time, as certainly as if they had been sent a card that said, "We're having a party." I think that's wonderful. I would have enjoyed it more if I hadn't kept thinking of Katz stumbling and gasping and searching for a lake by moonlight. Oh, and by the way, the loons are disappearing everywhere because their lakes are dying from acid rain. I had a rotten night, of course, and was up before 5 and back on the trail at first light. I continued on north in the direction I guessed Katz had gone, but with a nagging thought that I was plunging ever further into the 100-mile wilderness, not perhaps the best direction to go if he was somewhere nearby and in trouble. There was a certain incidental disquiet at the thought that I was on my own in the middle of nowhere, a disquiet briefly but vividly heightened when I stumbled in my haste on the return descent to the deep, nameless valley and came within a trice of falling 50 long feet with a messy bounce at the bottom. I hoped I was doing the right thing. Even flat out, it would take me 3 days, perhaps 4, to reach Abel Bridge in the campground. By the time I alerted authorities, Katz would have been missing for 4 or 5 days. On the other hand, if I turned now and went back the way we had come, I could be in Munson by the following afternoon. What I really needed was to meet somebody coming south who could tell me if they had seen Katz. But there was no one out on the trail. I looked at my watch. Of course there wasn't. It was only a little after 6 in the morning. There was a shelter at Chairback Gap 6 miles further on. I would reach it by 8 or so. With luck, there might still be someone there. I pressed on with more care and a queasy uncertainty. I clambered back over the pinnacle of Fourth Mountain, much harder with a pack, and into another wooded valley beyond. 4 miles after leaving Cloud Pond, I came to a tiny stream, barely worthy of the term, really just a slick of moist mud. Speared to a branch beside the trail in an intentionally prominent place was an empty pack of old gold cigarettes. Katz didn't really smoke, but he always carried a pack of old golds. In the mud by a fallen log were 3 cigarette butts. He had obviously waited here. So he was alive and hadn't left the trail and clearly had come this way. I felt immeasurably better. At least I was going in the right direction. As long as he stayed on the trail, I was bound eventually to overtake him. I found him 4 hours after setting off, sitting on a rock by the turnoff for West Chairback Pond, head inclined to the sun as if working on his tan. He was extensively scratched and muddy and wildly bedraggled, but otherwise looked okay. He was, of course, delighted to see me.
"Bryson, you old mountain man, you're a welcome sight. Where have you been?"
"I was wondering the same about you."
"Guess I missed the last watering hole."
I nodded. He nodded, too.
"Knew I had, of course. Soon as I got down to the bottom of that big cliff, I thought, shit, this can't be right."
"Why didn't you come back?"
"I don't know. I got it in mind somehow that you must have pushed on. I was real thirsty. I think I might have been a little confused, a little addled, as you might say. I was real thirsty."
"So what did you do?"
"Well, I pushed on and kept thinking I had to come to water sooner or later, and eventually I came to a mudslick."
"Where you left the cigarette pack?"
"You saw it? I'm so proud. Yeah, well, I soaked up some water there with my bandana, because I remembered that's what Fess Parker did once on the Davy Crockett show."
"How very enterprising."
He accepted the compliment with a nod.
"That took about an hour. And then I waited another hour for you and had a couple of smokes. And then it was getting dark, so I put my tent up, ate a Slim Jim, and went to bed. Then this morning I sponged up a little more water with my bandana, and I came on here. There's a real nice pond just down there, so I thought I'd wait here where there was water and hope that you'd come along eventually. I didn't think you'd leave me up here on purpose. But you're such a walking daydream, I could just imagine you getting all the way to Katahdin before you noticed I wasn't with you."
He put on a poncy accent.
"Oh, I say, delightful view. Don't you agree, Stephen? Stephen? Stephen! Now, where the deuce has he got to?"
He gave me a familiar smile.
"So I'm real glad to see you.
How'd you get so scratched up?" He looked at his arm, which was covered in a zigzag of dried blood.
"Oh, that? It's nothing."
"What do you mean it's nothing? It looks like you've been doing surgery on yourself."
"Well, I didn't want to alarm you, but I also got kind of lost."
"How?"
"Well, between losing you and coming upon the mudslick, I tried to get to a lake I saw from the mountain."
"Oh, Stephen, you didn't."
"Well, I was real thirsty, you know, and it didn't look too far, so I plunged off into the woods. Not real smart, right?"
"No."
"Yeah, well, I learned that real fast, because I hadn't gone more than half a mile before I was totally lost. I mean, totally lost. It's weird, you know, because you're thinking all you've got to do is go downhill to the water and come back the same way. And that shouldn't be too tough as long as you pay attention. But the thing is, Bryson, there's nothing to pay attention to out there. It's just one big wood. So when I realized I didn't have the faintest idea where I was, I thought, okay, well, I got lost by going downhill, so I'd better go back up. But suddenly there's a lot of uphills, and a lot of downhills, too, and it's real confusing. So I went up and up and up until I knew I'd gone a lot further than I'd come, and then I thought, well, Stephen, you stupid piece of shit, because I was getting a little cross with myself by this time, to tell you the truth, I thought, you must have gone too far, you jackass. So I went back down a ways, and that didn't work. So then I tried going sideways for a while, and, well, you get the picture.
You should never leave the trail, Stephen."
"Oh, now there's a timely piece of advice, Bryson. Thank you so much. That's like telling somebody who's died in a crash, drive safely now."
"Sorry."
"Forget it. I think maybe I'm still a little, you know, unsettled. I thought I was done for. Lost, no water, and you were the chocolate chip cookies."
"So how did you get back to the trail?"
"It was a miracle, I swear to God. Just when I was about to lie down and give myself to the wolves and bobcats, I look up, and there's a white blaze on a tree. And I look down, and I'm standing on the AT. At the mudslick, as a matter of fact. I sat down and had three smokes, one after the other, just to calm myself down. And then I thought, shit, I bet Bryson's walked by here while I've been blundering around in the woods, and he'll never come back because he's already checked this section of trail. And then I began to worry that I never would see you again. So I really was glad when you turned up. To tell you the truth, I've never been so glad to see another person in my whole life, and that includes some naked women.
There was something in his look. You want to go home? I asked. He thought for a moment.
Yeah, I do.
Me too. So we decided to leave the endless trail and stop pretending we were mountain men because we weren't. At the bottom of Chairback Mountain, 4 miles further on, there was a dirt logging road. We didn't know where it went, other than that it must go somewhere. An arrow on the edge of the map pointed south to Katahdin Ironworks, site of an improbable 19th-century factory in the woods, and now a state historical monument. According to my trail guide, there was a public parking at the old ironworks, so there must be a road out. At the bottom of the mountain, we watered up at a brook that ran past and then started off along the logging road. We hadn't been walking more than 3 or 4 minutes when there was a noise in the near distance. We turned to see a cloud of dust heading our way, led by an ancient pickup truck, moving at great speed. As it approached, I instinctively put my thumb out, and to my astonishment, it stopped about 50 feet past us. We ran up to the driver's window. There were 2 guys in the cab, both in hard hats and dirty from work. Loggers, obviously. "Where are you going?" asked the driver. "Anywhere," I said. "Anywhere but here." Chapter 21. So we didn't see Katahdin. We didn't even see Katahdin Ironworks, except as a glimpsed blur, because we shot past it at about 70 miles an hour on the bounciest, most terrifyingly hasty ride I ever hope to have in the back of a pickup truck on a dirt road. We held on for dear life in the open back, lifting our feet to let chainsaws and other destructive-looking implements slide past, first this way, then that, while the driver propelled us through the flying woods with reckless zest, bouncing over potholes with such vigor as to throw us a foot or two into the air, and negotiating curves as if in startled afterthought. In consequence, we alighted at the little community of Milo, 20 miles to the south, on unsteady legs and blinking at the suddenness with which our circumstances had changed. One moment we were in the heart of the wilderness, facing at least a 2-day hike to civilization, and now we were in the forecourt of a gas station on the edge of a remote little town. We watched the pickup truck depart, then took our bearings. "You want to get a Coke?" I said to Katz. There was a machine by the gas station door. He looked at it. "No," he said. "Maybe later." It was unlike Katz not to fall upon soft drinks and junk food with exuberant lust when the opportunity presented itself, but I believed I understood. There is always a measure of shock when you leave the trail and find yourself parachuted into a world of comfort and choice. But it was different this time. This time, it was permanent. We were hanging up our hiking boots. From now on, there would always be Coke and soft beds and showers and whatever else we wanted. There was no urgency now. It was a strangely subduing notion. Milo had no motel, but we were directed to a place called Bishop's Boarding House. It was a large old white house on a handsome street of substantial old houses, the kind where the garages were originally carriage houses, with quarters upstairs for the servants. We were received with warmth and bustling kindliness by the proprietor, Joan Bishop, a cheery, snowy-haired lady with a hearty down-east accent, who came to the door wringing flowery hands on an apron and waved us and our grubby packs into the spotless interior without a flicker of dismay. The house smelled wholesomely of fresh-baked pastry, garden tomatoes, and air nobly unmodified by fans or air conditioners, old-fashioned summer smells. She called us "you boys" and acted as if she had been expecting us for days, possibly years. "Goodness me, just look at you boys," she clucked in astonishment and delight. "You look as if you've been wrestling bears." I suppose we must have looked a sight. Katz was liberally covered in blood from his fraught stumble through the woods, and there was tiredness all over us, even in our eyes. "You boys go up and get yourselves cleaned up, and come down to the porch afterwards, and I'll have a nice jug of iced tea waiting for you. Or would you rather have lemonade? Never mind, I'll make both. Now go on." And off she bustled. "Thanks, Mom," we muttered in a dazzled and grateful unison. Katz was instantly transformed, so much so that he felt perhaps a trifle too much at home. I was wearily taking some things from my pack when he suddenly appeared in my room without knocking, and hastily shut the door behind him, looking flummoxed. Only a towel, clutched not quite adequately around his waist, preserved his hefty modesty.
"Little old lady," he said in amazement.
"Pardon?"
"Little old lady in the hallway,"
he said again. "It is a guest house, Stephen."
"Yeah, I hadn't thought of that," he said.
He peeked round the door and disappeared without elaboration. When we had showered and changed, we joined Mrs. Bishop on the screened porch, where we slumped heavily and gratefully in the big old porch chairs, legs thrust out the way you do when it's hot and you're tired. I was hoping that Mrs. Bishop would tell us that she was forever putting up hikers who had been foiled by the 100-mile wilderness, but in fact we were the first she could recall in that category.
"I read in the paper the other day that a man from Portland hiked Katahdin to celebrate his 78th birthday,"
she said conversationally. That made me feel immensely better, as you can imagine.
"I expect I'll be ready to try again by then," Kat said, running a finger along the line of scratch on his forearm.
"Well, it'll still be there, boys, when you're ready for it," she said.
She was right, of course. We dined in town at a popular restaurant, and afterwards, with the evening warm and congenial, went for a stroll. Milo was a sweetly hopeless town, commercially forlorn, far from anywhere and barely alive, but curiously likable. Perhaps it was just that it was our last night away from home.
"So, do you feel bad about leaving the trail?" Katz asked after a time.
I thought for a moment, unsure. I'd come to realize that I didn't have any feelings towards the AT that weren't thoroughly contradictory. I was weary of the trail, but captivated by it. Found the endless slog increasingly exhausting, but ever invigorating. Grew tired of the boundless woods, but admired their boundlessness. Enjoyed the escape from civilization, and ached for its comforts. All of this together, all at once, every moment, on the trail or off. "I don't know," I said. "Yes and no, I guess. What about you?" He nodded.
"Yes and no."
We walked along for some minutes, lost in small thoughts.
"Anyway, we did it,"
Kat said at last, looking up. He noted my quizzical expression. "Hiked Maine, I mean." I looked at him.
"Stephen, we didn't even see Mount Katahdin."
He dismissed this as a petty quibble.
"Another mountain," he said. "How many do you need to see, Bryson?"
I gave a small laugh.
"Well, that's one way of looking at it."
"It's the only way of looking at it," Katz went on, and quite earnestly. "As far as I'm concerned, I hiked the Appalachian Trail. I hiked it in snow, and I hiked it in heat. I hiked it in the south, and I hiked it in the north. I hiked it till my feet bled. I hiked the Appalachian Trail, Bryson."
"We missed out a lot of it, you know."
"Details," Kat sniffed.
I shrugged, not unhappily.
"Maybe you're right."
"Of course I'm right," he said, as if he were seldom otherwise.
We had reached the edge of town, by the little gas station stroke grocery store where the lumberjacks had dropped us. It was still open.
"So what do you say to some cream soda?" Kat said brightly. "I'll buy."
I looked at him with deepened interest.
"You don't have any money." "I know. I'll buy it with your money."
I grinned and handed him a $5 bill from my wallet.
"X-Files tonight," Kat said happily, very, very happily, and disappeared into the store.
I watched him go, shaking my head, and wondered how he always knew. So that, I'm afraid, is how it ended for me and Katz, with a 6-pack of cream soda in Milo, Maine. I continued to hike on and off in a modest way through the rest of summer and into autumn. In early November, when winter was blowing in and the hiking season was clearly at an end, I finally sat down at the kitchen table with my trail log and a calculator and totted up the miles I had done. I checked the numbers through twice, then looked up with an expression not unlike the one Katz and I had shared months before in Gatlinburg, when we realized we were never going to hike the Appalachian Trail. I had done 870 miles, considerably less than half, not a huge amount more than one-third.
All that effort and sweat and disgusting grubbiness, all of those endless plodding days, the nights on hard ground, all that added up to just 39.5% of the trail. Goodness knows how anyone ever completes the whole thing. I am filled with admiration and incredulity for those who see it through. But hey, and excuse me, 870 is still a lot of miles. Stephen Katz returned to Des Moines to a life of devoted sobriety. He calls from time to time and talks about coming out sometime to try the 100-mile wilderness again, though I don't suppose he ever will. I won't say that the experience changed our lives, and I can't speak for Katz, but I certainly gained an appreciation and respect for woods and wilderness and the colossal scale of America. I lost a lot of weight, and for a time was remarkably fit. Best of all, these days when I see a mountain, I look at it slowly and appraisingly, with a narrow, knowing gaze and eyes of chipped granite.
That was A Walk in the Woods by Bill Bryson, read by Bill Roberts. We do hope that you've enjoyed listening to this Chivers audiobook. For details of other Chivers recordings, please contact us, and we'll be delighted to send you a catalogue listing all our titles and recent releases. Our telephone number and address can be found on the box cover or in the catalogue.